I'm Howard Bryant, and this is Only a Game. We're going to start this week's show with a story about depression, a deadly punch, and a vote to ban college football. And we're going to ask questions. Should colleges even be playing football? And where is the sport going next? Only a Game's Martin Kessler connects the dots, beginning with a student group that has nothing to do with football.
Christina Platt is president of the Outing Club at Penn State University. They go hiking and canoeing.
I think a lot of us are the kids that might not quite fit in other places. You know, Penn State's a big football school, big sports school.
On fall weekends, when thousands of Penn State students are tailgating before games at Beaver Stadium, members of the Outing Club have often been miles away, backpacking in the woods of central Pennsylvania or beyond. That was going to be the plan for this year, too. Then last spring semester, Christina Platt got a message from an administrator in the campus recreation department.
Kind of just got this email. It was like, oh, we need to have a meeting. It's an organizational review.
For the previous year or so, there had been discussions about whether the Outing Club should fall under the university's club sports umbrella or under the umbrella of another department. So when Christina arrived for the meeting, she thought maybe the administration had finally found a permanent home for the club.
You know, they were just like, well, you know, you're too risky to be a club sport, and you're too risky to be a normal recognized student organization, so you guys are dissolved. And we were like, what?
After a review of 79 student organizations, Penn State had decided that three clubs had an unacceptable level of risk: the Diving Club, the Caving Club, and the Outing Club. Christina could continue to do things like host speakers and film screenings, but leading organized trips was a no-no.
I mean, we do strenuous hikes, but it's not like we're climbing cliffs or anything. We're just walking through the woods with backpacks. The real most dangerous thing is driving to the trailhead.
Penn State spokeswoman Lisa Powers declined our interview request. But in an email, she said the university had concerns about previous alcohol misuse and the distance of Outing Club trips from medical centers and cell phone service. She wrote, quote, "Penn State remains committed to the safety and well-being of our students." But while the Penn State Outing Club was told to stay inside due to safety concerns, this fall, tens of thousands of young men at universities across the U.S., including more than 100 at Penn State, will be playing tackle football. Ray Griffin hopes that they don't end up like him.
I have the mild cognitive impairment, which is the gateway to Alzheimer's.
Griffin played football in the NFL and for Ohio State in the 70s.
I have tinnitus in my ears, the ringing in my ears. And I also have, what else is that? I have another one. I did say mild cognitive impairment, didn't I? Couple other things I just can't remember at the time.
Ray Griffin is 62 years old. Do you think that you're living with CTE right now?
I know I am. The personality change, the outburst of anger, and I've had all those things. I have all those symptoms.
What's it like to live with that?
Well, it makes it kind of lonely, to be honest with you, because you don't want to be around people. I don't even have a lot of friends anymore, don't want friends, don't care about having friends. I don't even hang around my family or anything like that.
CTE, or chronic traumatic encephalopathy, is a neurodegenerative disease that causes memory loss, mood swings, and depression. It cannot be definitively diagnosed in the living. But last year, the Journal of the American Medical Association published the results of a Boston University study of the brains of 202 former football players that found the disease was highly prevalent. It was a convenient sample. The brains were donated, often because CTE was suspected. Nevertheless, the results were striking. Out of the 53 former college players in the study, 91% had CTE. Ray Griffin grew up in Columbus, Ohio in the 50s and 60s. He followed his older brother Archie to the hometown Ohio State Buckeyes and became a standout safety. But during a spring practice junior year, Griffin came in to make a tackle on a fullback rushing up the middle.
And I came up, made a hit on him, and I was out cold. And I didn't even remember anything until probably the next day.
Griffin says that after the hit, he started feeling depressed.
I know that I was just living in a real, real bad funk.
But when fall came around, Griffin was back on the field for his senior season.
And I'm going to tell you something, every hit hurt. I mean, it felt like I was dazed. And you get the headaches and things of that sort, bright light hurts your eyes. That was really bad. It was really, really bad.
But by the time next Saturday rolls around, you're back
up. Yeah. You don't miss a beat. You don't miss a beat.
Griffin went on to play in the NFL for 7 seasons. He says the depression didn't go away. Sometimes he'd be driving and just start sobbing.
So bad that sometimes I had to pull over and just cry. I tell you, man, I had a couple of times when I would have rather been dead. I'll be honest with you. I would have rather been dead.
After his pro football career ended in 1984, Griffin says he struggled to hold down a job. In 1993, he started getting treatment for his depression as well as drug addiction. He says he's now feeling better than he has in years, but Griffin still doesn't feel well enough to spend time with family and friends.
They have triggers that will just set me off. And I mean, that's the reality of this disease. I mean, once you get there, you just can't stop. That's why I will never, ever own a gun, because I know what can happen. I know I can lose it and just lose all control.
I asked Griffin whether he regrets playing football.
I enjoyed the game. The game was good to me and good for me. But in the end, it wasn't worth it.
But even as more stories like Ray Griffin's come out, and even as evidence mounts about the connection between head injuries and CTE, as well as other diseases like Parkinson's, the number of colleges offering the sport isn't shrinking. In fact, it's growing. This fall, 7 schools from Maine to Arizona are debuting teams. According to College Football Hall of Fame curator and historian Kent Stevens, there are now 776 colleges and universities funding football programs, the most there's been since an accurate count started being kept more than 3 decades ago. Why? Here's a good place to start.
The pressures are very real when you're a tuition-dependent institution.
That's Maureen Devlin, a higher education consultant who previously served as executive director of the Knight Commission on Intercollegiate Athletics. When Devlin says tuition-dependent institutions, she's referring to the hundreds and hundreds of small private colleges across the country that need a full class of paying students to keep their doors open.
Any school that is in that position has got to bring students in.
And there's one pretty big category of student who's becoming harder and harder to bring in: men. Since the late 70s, women have outnumbered men on college campuses, and the gap seems to be widening. Today, U.S. colleges are approximately 56% female and 44% male. College admissions officers have expressed fear that if their school becomes too lopsided, overall applications will drop. So how does football come into this?
That's a really good question. Football, at least at the Division III level, all of the teams that have been added, and more have been added than dropped in the 2000s, have been added for enrollment management purposes. And that is to bring in those scarce males and their tuition dollars.
Devlin says she sees Division III colleges with 110, 120, sometimes even 135 players on their football teams. And remember, this is Division III. None are on athletic scholarships. In 2006, John Hill, then athletic director at small Division III Shenandoah University, told the New York Times, quote, "You would be hard-pressed to find 5 admissions officers or 5 professors or 5 marketing experts that could guarantee you 100 new paying male students in 1 year. But you can hire 5 football coaches and they can do it. In fact, they can find you 200 if you want. Those boys just want to play." The 2,100-student Shenandoah University currently lists 114 players on its football roster. So small schools say they're adding football to build community, their brand, and to bring in tuition dollars. But meanwhile, there are a few individuals on college campuses who are fighting back. One of them is University of San Diego history professor Kenneth Serbin.
I grew up being a Cleveland Browns fan.
I'm sorry.
The original Browns.
But 23 years ago, Serbin was put on a path toward becoming a leader of the college football resistance. It happened the day after Christmas, when he learned his mother had been diagnosed with Huntington's disease. Huntington's is a genetic disorder that causes nerve cells in the brain to break down. There is no cure. Over the years, Serbin watched his mother become less and less like herself. In 2006, she died at the age of 68. Children of someone with Huntington's disease have a 50-50 chance of inheriting the gene. Serban was tested in 1999. He also has it.
And I am now 58 years old, and I'm at a stage where my mother already was debilitated by the disease, and so every day for me is a blessing.
After his mother's diagnosis, Serban became an advocate for people with Huntington's disease. He began studying the brain and sharing what he learned on a new blog. Then in 2012, something happened that was big news, especially in San Diego.
Word of a mysterious death, an apparent suicide by a powerful athlete.
Former San Diego Charger Junior Seau had shot himself in the chest. It was later determined that he had suffered from CTE. Serban noticed similarities between the symptoms of Huntington's disease and the symptoms of CTE, anger, depression, memory loss, not to mention the burden both diseases placed on family members and caregivers. And while there's no way to prevent Huntington's disease, Serban believed there was a way he could help people avoid CTE. He looked at his own university. The University of San Diego has fielded a football team for decades.
As a university, we should not be endangering the well-being of students. And we do have a moral obligation.
Serban soon learned he wasn't the only professor at USD who felt that way.
My name is Nadav Goldschmidt.
Goldschmidt is a psychology professor. He was born in Israel, but came to the U.S. for grad school. He took an immediate liking to American football. But Goldschmidt gradually grew uneasy about the brain injuries associated with the sport. And then 8 years ago, he had a son.
And I thought to myself, there's no chance in the world that I'm going to let him play football.
This sparked a very professorial chain of thinking.
Why wouldn't I accord the same protection that I accord my son to those in my community and those in my immediate community?
Goldschmidt decided he should fight to get rid of football at USD.
I think that people, to some degree, are entitled to do stupid things. The NFL can form their minor leagues, but given what we know, I don't think it should be played at the collegiate level.
Goldschmidt teamed up with Professor Serban and a USD physicist named Daniel Sheehan. They decided to do something that, as far as they knew, had never been done at another college. They were going to put forward a resolution to ban football at their institution. Not for budget reasons, but because they believed it was the right thing to do. The resolution was to be taken up and voted on by faculty at the academic assembly. Goldschmidt knew it would be a tough vote to win. Fighting the status quo is always hard. But he also knew that change can happen on college campuses, and in at least one instance, a popular college sport had been brought to an end, and it was because of faculty.
It was an incredible scene. They would put chairs on the basketball floor and actually draw a couple more thousand people than they could for basketball. They had a band that would play before the bout started.
That's journalist and author Doug Moe describing a typical scene at the Fieldhouse in Madison when the University of Wisconsin boxing team held a match. Over 14,000 fans would come to watch the boys led by John Walsh, coach of the Badgers from 1934 to 1958.
A fire marshal once came up to him and said, "Look, I love college boxing. We're having a blast here, but you got way too many people in the Fieldhouse. Cut it back or we're breaking the fire code here."
After World War I, boxing had taken off as a varsity sport on the East Coast, eventually spreading across the country. But the number one college boxing team, the Alabama Crimson Tide of the sport, if you will, was the Wisconsin Badgers. With Walsh as coach, Wisconsin won 8 national championships. But even back in the 1940s, there were people who believed boxing didn't belong on college campuses. In 1948, a Wisconsin economics professor made a motion to get rid of the sport, citing health concerns. The motion failed, but opposition kept growing. In 1959, a college dean told Sports Illustrated, "If boxing is bad, it is worst for the men in our universities. Their brains must be good. And injury to such brains is a very serious matter." Supporters of the sport argued that college boxing built confidence and that it kept alive, quote, an ideal of rugged fitness on which our country was founded. And then in 1960, the Badgers hosted the NCAA College Boxing Championship. One of Wisconsin's own fighters was looking to repeat as the national champion at 165 pounds. His name was Charlie Moore.
Probably the most beloved guy on campus.
Moore helped out at a church. He once brought a panhandler to a team meal. Moore told his coach, "I'll pay for him." 1960 was Moore's senior year, and he reached the championship bout against a fighter from San Jose State. In the second round, Moore took a hit.
It was a punch to the side of the head, a strong punch to the side of the head.
Moore hit the canvas. The referee started the count. After 2 seconds, Moore was back up. The fight resumed. But then Moore's legs started to wobble. The ref called the fight.
He walked back to the locker room under his own power, sat down on a stool, and in very short order slipped off the stool and into a coma and was ambulanced to the University of Wisconsin Hospital.
The punch had torn a major vein in Moore's brain. He was rushed into surgery. Moore's life, and some believe the future of college boxing, was on the line.
We'll be right back after a quick break. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
Hey, this is Stretch Armstrong.
And this is Bobbito Garcia, the hosts of What's Good.
We're talking with one of the coolest cats around, Lenny Kravitz.
I remember this kid walked up to us in the hallway and he goes, "Your dad's white." And he pointed his finger like that.
Subscribe now.
I'm Howard Bryant. We're going to pick up our story in the year 1960. University of Wisconsin boxer Charlie Moore was rushed into surgery after taking a punch to the side of the head during a bout for the national championship. Here's Only a Game's Martin Kessler.
A 3-hour operation stopped the bleeding and drained the blood, but tremendous damage had already been done to Charlie Moore's brain.
He died 8 days later on Easter Sunday.
Soon after, Wisconsin political science professor David Feldman was having lunch with a group of colleagues. He mentioned that Moore's death was a shame.
Another professor said to him, "You know, well, why don't you do something about it?"
Feldman reportedly turned over his placemat and began writing a motion to abolish boxing. At the next faculty meeting, the motion was taken up. It had been 12 years since the first attempt by a Wisconsin professor to ban boxing had failed. But after the death of Charlie Moore, Wisconsin faculty voted to end the team. Soon after, the NCAA decided to discontinue boxing.
And at that point, most varsity programs disbanded.
Change is going to come from faculty putting pressure.
That's University of San Diego professor Nadav Goldschmidt again. Last fall, he and his colleagues Kenneth Serbin and Daniel Sheehan asked the Academic Assembly for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences to ban football. It was a non-binding resolution. Many professors made arguments for keeping football.
They're defending the values of the sport, the camaraderie, and so on and so forth.
Others said that if you play football, it does not mean that you're going to get CTE. It's just increases the likelihood.
Then it was time to vote.
The vote was 50 against the resolution.
Only 26 voted in favor.
We lost resoundingly. There's no question about that.
But, and this is important, there were 30 abstentions. If those 30 abstentions had been in favor of our vote, we would have carried the day.
The University of San Diego opens its 2018 football season next Saturday. Nadav Goldschmidt now hopes that professors at other universities will pick up the cause. But Kenneth Serbin thinks change will come from other places.
I think what's really going to happen is the moms are going to stop their kids from playing football. And I think that these colleges are going to face lawsuits. I mean, that is the one big thing that I think convinces people to change, which is when their pocketbook is damaged in some way.
Chris Dorr is a partner with Edelson PC in Chicago. He says the law firm currently represents over 1,000 former college football players in more than 100 class action lawsuits against the NCAA, conferences, and universities regarding head injuries.
The number is growing because we are continually contacted by people that are suffering from these issues.
So is it just like a typical Monday morning you show up and there's like 5 new people who want to be represented?
At least.
One of the former college football players who reached out to Edelson PC is 62-year-old Ray Griffin, the former Ohio State safety. Does Ray's story stand out to you, or is it fairly representative of your clients?
I would say it's very representative. I mean, and there are many worse stories than Ray's.
Edelson PC argues that information about the long-term effects of head injuries has been available to the NCAA, conferences, and universities for decades, and that not enough was done to protect athletes. The NCAA's chief legal counsel has called the class action cases questionable and said the NCAA does not believe that these complaints present legitimate legal arguments. But could litigation and all the costs that will come with it actually bring an end to college football?
No.
That's Michael McCann, Sports Illustrated legal analyst and associate dean at the University of New Hampshire's law school.
The NCAA, I think, has accepted this as part of their business.
McCann believes football isn't going anywhere at bigger schools like Alabama, Notre Dame, and Florida. The sport is too profitable and too big a part of school culture. But
if we're looking at smaller colleges that lose money on football and that will lose more money, not only because of payouts from litigation, but also higher insurance rates, mm-hmm. it could prove meaningful.
Universities pay for insurance to cover many things, including lawsuits. And with so much uncertainty over concussion litigation, those insurance policies could become more and more expensive. All of that means the cost of running a football program could grow, and sponsoring football might not be worth it for the hundreds of smaller Division III colleges across the country, even those that need more men to enroll.
Schools will start to drop football.
That's higher education consultant Maureen Devlin again.
The elite liberal arts schools that don't need football for enrollment management by any stretch, I think they'll be the first to start to drop football, and that it may grow from there.
But Devlin still believes it'll be years before that process gains momentum. In the meantime, tens of thousands of young men from more than 770 colleges and universities will play football this fall. And that number will likely grow. In addition to the 7 new programs starting to play full football schedules this year, at least 5 more schools are already planning to join the fray before 2020.
That story was from Only a Game's Martin Kessler. Next Saturday, Penn State hosts Appalachian State in its college football season opener. Penn State Outing Club president Christina Platt says her club recently received permission to go on day hikes within 50 miles of the university. Her focus this year is on proving to Penn State administrators that the Outing Club can operate safely. It's time for 3 stories you should know.
What message do you have for Courtney Smith?
Well, I have a message for everyone involved in this. I'm sorry that we're in this situation.
That's Ohio State football coach Urban Meyer speaking at a press conference on Wednesday. Meyer received a 3-game suspension, and that's where we're going to start this week. I'm joined by The Wall Street Journal's Rachel Bachman. Welcome back, Rachel Bachman.
Great to be here, Howard.
And by Jeanette Howard, columnist from The Athletic. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Howard.
Rachel Bachman, you are the lucky one. Please tell us about what is the latest college football embarrassment.
Yes, well, of course, as you say, Urban Meyer was suspended for 3 games for failing to report allegations of domestic violence against an assistant coach to university officials. But the real news started after the press conference that announced his suspension. A report of investigative findings the university released late Wednesday night really cast Meyer in a dimmer light. It detailed his changing stories about what he knew and when, multiple excuses for why he kept this coach on despite the coach missing practices, taking high school coaches to strip clubs. And the report even detailed Meyer discussing with a coworker how to delete text messages from his phone so they wouldn't be made public. Now, Meyer is 73-8 as Ohio State coach. He has a national championship. I want to know, are we done pretending that we want our coaches to be leaders of men and role models? Shouldn't we just admit that as long as they're winning, they can do what they want?
That sort of seems to be what's happening, right, Jeanette?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've always known it, and this is just another iteration. The thing that's different at Ohio State is they got rid of Woody Hayes for slugging a player. They got rid of Jim Tressel for players getting tattoos and other swag. This is a little bit of a departure for them, and I almost wonder if there isn't a Tressel effect where they thought, like, we did that and we really didn't have to, and they overcorrected this time, because I think it's hard to maintain that Urban Meyer should still have a job.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question that Urban Meyer shouldn't have a job if any of this matters, and I think, Rachel, to the point you were making about the rest of the report, not only was it the report, but it was also the press conference where they didn't even mention Courtney Smith by name and instead decided to talk about Buckeye Nation. What does this say in a post-Ray Rice world that this was the response from Ohio State?
Well, it's obviously very troubling. I think that one of the things that fans certainly are talking about now is they're contesting the allegations themselves. To me, that slightly misses the point because, as this report detailed, there are other troubling things about this behavior, about Meyer's reaction to it. And certainly, when there are repeated allegations of domestic violence, you have to take serious action. just as a precautionary measure.
We talk about these things in terms of, well, how come women don't come forward? I think this entire, the last 3 days is more proof as to why women don't come forward.
Yeah, but I think Courtney Smith has been a different kind of person. I mean, there are people that are timid when they come forward or almost apologetic. I think she has been willing to take on Buckeye Nation, if you want. I even hate the term,
yes.
But I think she's been willing to do this knowing what the blowback would be. And I think, if anything, if you focus on her and not Ohio State, this is an affirming story about somebody who had the courage to not be kind of cowed by the forces that she knew she'd encounter.
Yeah, that's a tremendous point. And also, however, when I do think about it, you still think that at the end of the day, that courage should be rewarded by courage from the university. And so far, it hasn't been.
Yeah, I agree.
And the other part of this, too, Rachel, is that look at the players. You got Terrell Pryor in that Tressel scandal. He was suspended 5 games. You had Todd Gurley was suspended 4 games when he was at Georgia for accepting $3,000 of what, autograph memorabilia? It's not as if the university system or the NCAA doesn't like to punish people. They just don't like to punish certain people.
Right. The jury's sort of still out on whether the NCAA will even take any steps at all.
Jeanette Howard, your turn.
I'd like to talk about the NFL, because as if the NFL doesn't have enough culture war issues going on, the league is committed this year to a supercharged version of analytics it's calling Next Gen Stats. Basically, it's data points collected from tracking devices in every player's shoulder pads. But for the first time this year, clubs will have access to data about players from all 32 teams, not just their own. Now, it's up to each team to make sense of the information, but the expectation is very soon teams will build predictive models that go beyond opposing teams' tendencies, and they'll be able to more scientifically compare individual players across the league. Now, if you're a player especially, do you like this tracking idea, or do you feel you're contributing to your own demise and giving the club another hammer in contract talks? If you're a fan or a coach, will next-gen stats distort football the way analytics such as defensive shifts are being blamed for killing baseball? Or am I just being a crank?
Rachel Bachman, is Jeanette just being a crank?
Well, I welcome cranks. I think cranks are really interesting and kind of ironically fun.
Cranks
but,
are us.
Exactly. But, you know, I'm actually skeptical to what extent coaches are going to adopt this information. I'll give you an example. In the NBA, it really took about 5 years, at least 5 years, between the time when data showed that it was a big advantage to take a lot of three-point shots and the time when teams actually started doing that. And so given that football tends to be sort of more change-averse, more hidebound, I'm not certain that coaches will buy into the data. I think they might be a little skeptical and wait and see, and maybe wait for some innovators to experiment.
Well, I actually think this is going to be great. I want it to happen. And the reason why I want it to happen is because when Jeanette talks about baseball, the complete diminishment of the manager has been one of the byproducts of all this analytics revolution. And so now you've got the front office and the analytics departments essentially making out the lineup in baseball. I just would love to see the front office tell Bill Belichick who he's going to be playing. But Jeanette, the one part of this that is really sort of chilling is that this is a labor trap for players, isn't it?
It is a player trap, if you ask me, because it's one of the chilling things is that they're going to collect these data points on players that are even away from the play. So you're being evaluated on plays you're not even in. You know, I mean, there's all kind of applications that are tantamount to almost like, it sounds silly, but like spying on you.
Sure. Well, and we do know the end game to all of this is lowering player salaries and making players less valuable than they actually are. Okay, I'm up. Interleague play, threat or menace? The thrill is gone. The novelty of Yankees-Dodgers outside of the World Series has worn off, and there never was any novelty to Angels-Reds. Besides, how can you play a sport every day under two different sets of rules? I mean, who does that? 2 years ago, the Tigers were in a pennant race, but had to play their final 3 games in Atlanta, where they lost the DH and one of their best hitters, Victor Martinez. Unfair disadvantage to the Tigers. This year, during the final week, the Cubs play at the White Sox and get to add a DH. Unfair advantage, Cubs. So, Jeanette, interleague's got to go, am I right?
I don't mind interleague as much as the DH.
Really?
I mean, I think if you had DH in both leagues, the interleague thing solves itself. And
you
want to
watch Chris Archer? You want to watch Chris Archer hit? He just got injured swinging a bat the other day.
I want to see Bartolo Colon hit 100 times a season. That's what I want.
I actually think that regardless of whether it stays or goes, it's kind of irrelevant. And here's an analogy for you. Coloring books for adults. So several, stay with me here. Several years ago, these were on a rocket ship ride. Suddenly, overnight, they were the hottest things in bookstores. They actually helped keep some bookstores in business because they were selling so much and there was such a high profit margin. Now, of course, the market has crashed. They're really largely a fad. And I think, you know, there was a sort of a similar effect to Interleague play. Now the thrill is gone.
Yeah, and it's been 21 years. And I just don't think it makes a lot of sense to play a sport every single day under two sets of rules. I think it's just a complete disadvantage to somebody.
But then what if you use that logic, how is the World Series okay?
Because it's the World Series. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been The Wall Street Journal's Rachel Bachman. Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you very much.
And, of course, Jeanette Howard, columnist for The Athletic. Thank you, Jeanette.
Thank you, Howard.
During World War II, more than 10,000 Japanese Americans were interned at Manzanar, 3 hours north of Los Angeles. The camp was home to a small judo dojo.
Shindokan. They called it that themselves, and it was a joke because the building was so rickety, it quaked and shaked.
Just ahead, what happened when a Los Angeles police officer brought a group of young athletes to compete at Manzanar? And remember to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at OnlyAGameNPR.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, one of your new hosts for On Point. We take on the news with the smartest guests and live calls from every corner of the country. NPR's David Folkenflik hosts the Friday Week in the News. Join David and me for On Point.
I'm Howard Bryant. Coming up next week on Only a Game, the story of Ora Washington, the little-known basketball pioneer who will be inducted into the Naismith Hall of Fame in September. But now, the week's news with Charlie Pierce. Hiya, Charlie.
Hey, Howard.
So the San Francisco 49ers traded Eli Harrell to the Lions on Thursday for a conditional seventh-round pick. It isn't the kind of deal that would make news, except all three players who originally protested police brutality in 2016, Colin Kaepernick, Eric Reid, and now Harrell, are gone from the 49ers. Now, being traded to the Lions is punishment enough, as far as I'm concerned, but is this another sort of draconian move punishing these protesters?
I don't know, although apparently trades between the 49ers and the Lions are now an NFL tradition because they've done it three preseasons in a row. I think that the situation and the NFL's incredible bungling of handling the whole Kaepernick situation creates certainly an atmosphere in which you got to wonder. Now, all three of the guys who first started this have now been trained.
And Eric Reid still doesn't have a job.
And the most talented, two of them haven't even been hired yet, and the most talented one who plays the hardest position probably never will.
Yep.
So, I mean, I think the reactionary portion of this story is the fact that people like Eric and Colin Kaepernick haven't been hired, more so than this trade.
We talked about Maryland coach DJ Durkin last week. Following the death of Jordan McNair, we pretty much agreed that he should be fired. Now, Urban Meyer gets three games. Let's repeat that. Three games for essentially lying to university administrators about what he knew about the domestic violence history of former assistant coach Zach Smith. Now, I know you've got something to say on this.
They really threw the pamphlet at him, didn't they? They threw the paper airplane at him. He's going to be suspended for the first three games, two of which are walkovers, and the third one is TCU, and he can certainly coach that one from the booth. It's not like he's barred from the stadium either, by the way. But the report is just a remarkable thing. There's absolutely no doubt that he lied to the world about his knowledge of this. He lied to the university. He lied to the investigators. He lied to the media at Big Ten Media Day. And the board is completely willing to admit that. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And yet this is what they came up with. They're suspending guys four games for selling their shoes. Give me a break.
Now brace yourself.
Okay.
After nearly a half century of life on this planet, Phil Mickelson has joined Twitter. He even says that Instagram and Facebook are next.
Oh, I don't think I want to follow Phil Mickelson's Instagram. I just don't. But he's wonderful. He says, I've stayed off of social media, but after looking at it, there is so much good that far outweighs the bad. Oh, young Padawan, you will learn.
Famous last
word. You will learn, my friend.
Thursday was Kobe Bryant's 40th birthday.
Happy birthday,
happy
Kobe.
Happy birthday, Kobe. And the Detroit Pistons wanted to wish Kobe a happy birthday. And how did they do it? By offering up a very, very special throwback Thursday. Four photos of their 2004 NBA title win over the Lakers. There was one of Rasheed Wallace blocking Kobe's shot. There was another of Ben Wallace clogging the lane with, against Kobe. And there's another of Ben Wallace dunking on Kobe. And lastly, one of Darvin Ham, the dear forgotten Darvin Ham, harassing a Kobe jumper. So was this a coincidence or just one A-list major league troll?
Hey, it's a major league. Hey, listen, when you're trolling somebody with the Sheed, that's major league trolling right there. Darvin Ham is one thing. Ben Wallace is another. But when you've got a picture of the Sheed being absolutely ferocious blocking his shot, you're aiming for the innards of somebody.
Well, and the mystery was solved when later in the right. afternoon they sent Kobe a happy birthday. By the way, it's Kobe's birthday, so we all knew that this was a big league troll in good fun.
Yeah, it was. But and it's, you know, good for the Pistons for doing that. I don't know who thought it up, but they need a raise.
Finally, we ended last week's segment by talking about the Browns' plan to flood the streets of Cleveland with foamy suds, free beer, that is, when or perhaps if they win a game this season. But now we got news out of Vegas saying that our skepticism might be unfounded. What's going on there?
Apparently, a lot of people are betting on Cleveland to actually do something this year, whether it's to win their division, win their conference, or yes, indeed, win the Super Bowl.
Why do I always laugh when we talk about the Browns
they're
winning?
They're 60-1 to win the Super Bowl. They didn't win a game last year. And they've got, at best, a journeyman quarterback, and behind him, a rookie. They're still the Browns, first of all.
Still the Browns.
Right there. Something bad is going to happen around midseason. We don't even know what that's going to be. But apparently, the smart money is not very smart this year. I would probably take the 7-1 to win the AFC North, because you can never, a division you can never tell. But I'm not going to take the 60-1 to win the Super Bowl.
Prop bets for everybody. Charlie's putting money down.
There we go.
Who's going to score first? The Browns or the opponents in the first quarter?
When's the first game they win? That's the prop bet.
I like that.
When do they have to give the beer away?
It was just an exhibition game Thursday and doesn't count, but the Browns beat the defending champion.
What's the score, Howard?
It was 5-0.
Boy, I'll tell you what. Terry Francona's really got a moving, doesn't he?
I was like, who hit the grand slam?
It's hard to say now. They've got so many hitters in that lineup.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time. And he joins us each week on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Art.
Did you know the best way to never miss a second of the show is to subscribe to the Only a Game podcast? Subscribe now at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. In a remote section of California desert, just east of the Sierra Nevada, you can find all that remains of Manzanar, one of 10 internment camps where Japanese Americans were held during World War II. During the war, there was virtually no contact between the people of Los Angeles and Manzanar, 3 hours to the north. But between 1943 and 1944, young athletes got a glimpse of life inside the camp, with help from a Los Angeles police officer and the sport of judo. Susan Vallett has the story.
I'm in right now, shoulder-length sage, and sort of tromping through the brush and watching out for snakes.
The judo dojo at Manzanar isn't easy to find.
So I've made it through to a dirt road that runs through Manzanar, and there is an extremely large, very old poplar tree.
Next to the poplar tree, amid dead desert shrubs and green sagebrush, are rocks that outline where the dojo used to be. And it's here where one of Manzanar's most fascinating sports stories took place, during a wartime filled with anti-Japanese hysteria. Richard C. was a kid in Los Angeles back then.
My grandfather was Chinese, my father was half Chinese, my mother was white. None of us looked Asian, except my grandfather.
I found C. through an old photo from the dojo. It shows a group of 10 people wearing judo suits, posing in front of that poplar tree. Their names are handwritten across their chests. C. is in the front row, kneeling. He's the only one in the photo still alive. He's now 88.
Well, at the time, we were living in the house of a Japanese family that had evacuated. But they had a space underneath the house where they had stored a lot of stuff, not just of their own, but of other people.
For his birthday one year, C and his family flew a Japanese wind sock, the kind that's shaped like a fish.
And somebody across the sort of valley looked at reported us to the FBI because they said that we were flying a Japanese flag.
Shortly after the war started, C's Uncle Ted, who was only about 2.5 years older than him, started taking judo lessons.
Some of our favorite movies when we were kids were the Mr. Moto movies. They were about supposedly a Japanese detective, played by Peter Lorre, and he knew judo.
Mr. Moto's up there.
And Ted wanted to be able to learn how to do all that, you know, throw people around and stuff. And I sort of went with him.
C and his uncle took lessons from Jack Sergel, an LAPD sergeant who'd become the sensei of a nearby dojo after all of the Japanese senseis were forced to leave. Sergel had friends interned at Manzanar.
The only people who could, at that time, award a promotion from a white belt to a brown belt or brown belt, you know, one of those degrees, was a person who had received their training in Japan or by Japanese. And that's what we went up to Manzanar for, because there was a tournament.
Clyde Titchener was also in the group. He recounted the experience in an oral history interview that's part of the Manzanar National Historic Site collection.
Just a matter of if you could scrounge up the gas to take you there, since it was rationed at that time.
Titchener said the Manzanar Dojo had open sides all around. The internees had a special name for it.
Shindokan. They called it that themselves, and it was a joke because the building was so rickety. It quaked and shaked, and the Shindo means shaking and quaking.
Titchener, C, and the others would compete in matches to determine who would earn a promotion to a higher rank.
It was a contest, and the people who watched it were just the people who lived here, and plus what Caucasians were with us. There were probably 20 to 50 people milling around outside the open sides, and of course, they all knew that we were visiting as a Caucasian group, and this was kind of interesting to them, I'm sure, and they wanted to take a look at us to see if we looked like normal Caucasians, I guess.
Richard C. was young enough that he only remembers random things about that Manzanar tournament. It was his first trip away from home. He got to stay in a hotel and eat steak dinner in town, which was a rare treat during the war. And he could actually see the stars, something he'd never experienced in Los Angeles.
At the time, I didn't really think of it as a concentration camp. Exactly. You know, but that's what it was. And maybe because I was so young, it all seemed pretty much, I mean, it was strange because I was away from home, but the camp was just one of the strange things. Yeah, it was hot, and it was, I think, at a higher altitude than most of us were used to, certainly I was used to. And I got winded really quick. I won the first one and pulled a draw on the second. So I did get a promotion.
Clyde Titchener did earn a promotion, but he said that wasn't the only thing he took away from the tournament.
They treated us very normally, same as we treated them. But they were, of course, happy to see there were some Americans that weren't prejudiced against them. And to us, there were the Japanese who were nationals from Japan who made a war against us. And then there were these other Japanese people that had lived in particularly the Los Angeles area who by presidential edict, got moved out for a while. We didn't see why, because Japan had decided to be warlike, it had anything to do with them.
But the Hearst newspapers in Los Angeles didn't see it that way. Sergel's group took several trips to the dojo over the course of about a year. Then the LA Herald and Examiner, both very anti-Japanese at the time, learned about the white judo students going up to Manzanar.
They'd print anything that anybody said without worrying about facts or anything else. Just the more horrendous they could make it, like women students exchanging holds with Japanese internees.
Girls wrestle Japanese men.
From the LA Examiner, August 28, 1944.
Los Angeles girls are being taken to Manzanar by a Los Angeles policeman to wrestle interned male Japanese judo style.
LA Police Commissioner Al Cohen called for and got an investigation into LAPD Sergeant and Sensei Jack Sergel. The commissioner called judo a form of emperor worship and demanded that Sergel be fired for taking these kids up to Manzanar to do it.
Dreamt up the craziest fallacies. He didn't know what the hell he was talking about from the word go.
No charges were ever brought against Sergel. But around the same time, Tichenor said something else happened at their dojo in L.A.
I can remember the night that Jim Cagney...
Come out and take it, you dirty yellow-bellied rat, or I'll give it to you through the door.
Yes, that's Jim Cagney, the Hollywood actor.
Showed up at the dojo and sat in the bleachers watching us. And he did it two times, and then Jack got to talking with him and everything. What Cagney was looking for was somebody to take place of this Japanese police captain in the movie Blood on the Sun.
So in November of 1944, Sergel resigned from the LAPD. He changed his name to John Halloran and started his career in Hollywood movies, beginning with 1945's Blood on the Sun. It featured a judo fight scene between Cagney and Sergel, or Halloran, who was made up to look Japanese and played Captain Oshima.
You're very clever, Mr. Conlon, but there's one flaw in your cleverness. It is as easy to kill you with these as with that. In fact, I prefer it that way. Japanese fashion.
But I think he was making money and getting into the movies, and he didn't need the police department and all the guff they were giving him. Why he changed his name just because he was in the movie, I don't know, maybe because it got away from the stigma he'd got with the police department on judo.
Clyde Tichenor stuck with judo and helped to teach it. Richard C. fell away from the sport. And if you look closely at old films like Rosemary's Baby and TV shows like The Lone Ranger and The Cisco Kid, you just might spot the man who brought groups of athletes to a Japanese-American internment camp to do judo.
That story came to us from reporter Susan Vallett. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Matthew Stock. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our senior producer is Karen Given. I'm Howard Bryant. Only a Game returns next week. Thank you for listening.